You're listening to a podcast from the RSA. You can find out more about RSA events and projects and how to get involved with the fellowship by visiting our website, thersa.org.
Good afternoon. I'm Anthony Painter. I'm director of the RSA's Action and Research Centre. I'm delighted to welcome you all here today for this special event. Today is the first day that parties have began campaigning in earnest, at least at a local level, since Monday night's tragic events in Manchester. It's important that we pause to reflect and remember those 22 lives, almost all children and young adults, that were lost as they were enjoying a special night out. Our thoughts are also with the bereaved families, the emergency services, who again did an incredible job, and the people of Manchester and many other northern cities who feel an acute sense of loss and responded with alacrity, fortitude, and togetherness. I can't do any better than the words of Tony Walsh. Always remember, never forget, forever Manchester, choose love. We will discuss the impact of the attack on the election, but very much in a knowledge that it is a loss that is of absolute privacy, not the impact on politics. Now, it's fairly obvious why we've gathered these brilliant speakers together at such short notice. There is an election, and we need to navigate it. And today's speakers are first-class analysts. We're lucky enough to have with us today Julia Rampen, who's digital news editor of The New Statesman, to my immediate right, and Katie Balls, who's political correspondent at The Spectator, to my extreme left. Cordelia, the obvious jokes. Cordelia Hay, research director at polling agency Britain's Think, to my far right. And Miranda Green, who's a former press secretary to Paddy Ashdown and now a journalist at the Financial Times, to my immediate left. So without further ado, I'm going to pass over to Cordelia, who's going to give us some sort of analysis of the polls and focus groups and how the voters are reacting to this election campaign as it unfolds.
Brilliant, thank you so much. Firstly, just to explain a little bit about what Britain Thinks is, because people's favourite question to ask me is, does Britain really think? We're a research agency with a particular focus on qualitative research, lots of focus groups, and what we've been doing through this election and previous election campaigns is tracking the sentiment of voters in some key swing seats to find out what they're seeing and what they're feeling on the ground. We also take a look at the polls and see what they're saying, but conveniently for us, we don't do any polls, which is just as well at the moment, given the current state that the industry is in. From our work, and particularly from focus groups, it feels like there are a few interesting sort of paradoxes in public opinion to pull out in terms of how voters are feeling about this election and what they're picking up and what's influencing their vote. I think the first really interesting point is that this has probably rightly been described as the Brexit election, yet no one really wants to talk about or engage with the details of Brexit. So when you ask people what's the number one issue at the moment, what's the number one issue in this election, they will parrot back at you without kind of pause for thought. Brexit, it's been the top of the Ipsos Mori's issue index for months and was the highest it's ever been last month and remains at the top there. But actually, it's quite striking how little the parties are actually talking about Brexit and talking about the detail of what they're going to do and talk about the detail of what Brexit is going to look like. And moreover, what's really striking is that people haven't really picked up on this, voters in focus groups, and they don't really tend to mind. For them, Brexit feels incredibly complex. For most, it feels like a done deal. So there are a group of members of the public who we call devastated pessimists who will never get over Brexit and will just, you know, feel awful about it forever and will never, ever, 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 ever come to terms with the result. But actually, we're looking at close to two-thirds now of the public who are either accepting of it and resigned to it and want, you know, politicians to get on with it, or feel very positive about Brexit. So for most people, Brexit's seen as a done deal and they want to see follow-through on it. But it feels very, very complicated. When you ask people what kind of Brexit they want, a hard Brexit or a soft Brexit, they really struggle to engage with the detail of that. And quite frankly, what they're looking for is to sort of defer responsibility for what kind of Brexit is best to Britain, to someone they trust to deliver that Brexit. And this is why this is the Brexit election, but it's actually the leadership election. And the issue that matters above all else in this election is leadership and competence. And that, of course, really plays to Theresa May's strengths. So she is, in sort of polling figures, one of the most popular leaders, you know, since the 1970s. And it obviously really, really, really harms Jeremy Corbyn, who is one of the most unpopular leaders since the 70s, and sort of at minus 42 was his latest popularity score. The second paradox is that what is persuading voters in this election is what they say really clearly that they don't want. So when you ask people what turns them off about politics and politicians, and they have a lot to say here, they'll tell you time and time again that it's career politicians who aren't genuine, who just parrot out the same lines, and what they want is someone authentic, who's got real ideas and communicates policies in detail. And in this election, you could argue that actually Labour are doing some things to give them the latter. When you ask people what they're picking up in this election, they're much more likely to talk about Labour policies than Conservative policies. And some of those policies on face value feel very, very appealing indeed. Nationalisation of some industries feels very appealing. Taxing the rich to pay for, well, everything, but particularly the NHS, feels very appealing. To a lesser degree, student fees. And all they're really hearing from the Conservatives is one line, the strong and stable leadership mantra, which is arguably being delivered in this very wooden way. But it isn't working for Labour, and it's working really well for the Conservatives, and that feels counterintuitive because it's not what voters say that they want. It doesn't work for Labour because they don't have the leadership or the credibility to pull it off. And it's not just about Jeremy Corbyn. It's about a long-standing problem that Labour has, that the sums aren't seen to add up, which way predates Jeremy Corbyn. And voters just aren't getting a clear message about Labour's strength or agenda. And it speaks to the same mistake that Labour made in the 2015 general election, in that they say a lot of things, but it doesn't really add up to anything. And it doesn't really address voters, most voters' key concerns about voting for them as a party. So the Linton-Crosby strategy that Theresa May and the Conservatives are following absolutely religiously is really, really boring, and voters do find it boring. In the last election, someone said, if David Cameron says one more time I've got a long-term economic plan, I am, you know, leaving the country, I can't hear it anymore. But it really, really worked. And Theresa May's strong and stable leadership message is so boring if you're at all engaged in politics. But the thing is, you need to say things a million times before they cut through, and that ultimately is proving very effective. Third paradox is that we still have not learnt the lessons of Brexit, and politicians and parties and sort of Westminster people are still very much in their bubble and sort of drinking the Kool-Aid or the opposite of that, whatever that would be. So a good example here is Theresa May's U-turn. This felt like a really, really, really seismic moment in Westminster, both the kind of decision leading up to the U-turn and the U-turn itself. What's quite interesting is that the decision was made by Conservative ministers, or prompted by a perceived sort of narrowing of the gap between the Conservatives and Labour in the polls, which is absolutely right. But it seems like no one really looked at what was driving that, because the Conservatives weren't actually seeing a dip. It was that Labour was starting to do a little bit better from a very low position. So Labour was starting to see their vote share increase, taken from the smaller parties, the Greens and the Lib Dems in particular. And that was actually what was causing that narrowing in the polls. There were, of course, some voters on the doorstep, I think understandably feeling very worried about the policy. And when it started to get the label of the dementia tax, then it felt something that could really escalate and turn into a real problem for the Conservatives. But actually, in our work, voters were as likely to be talking about the Conservative stance on fox hunting as they were about social care policy or the dementia tax. And then the other sort of key point is the nature of the U-turn itself, which, you know, just on Monday night, that just felt like this was going to change the course of the election. Everyone seemed to think that. And we, from our research, just couldn't understand why. We put on our panel that we're running with voters at the moment, you know, what do you think of Theresa May's U-turn? A lot of people had to ask us what on earth we were talking about. They hadn't engaged with the policy in the first place. They were only just hearing about it now. And really, it did not feel like a big deal to them in the great scheme of things. And I think you need to think back to some key moments in the 2015 campaign that felt like seismic moments. You know, Russell Brand, non-doms, that was such a popular policy. Did it matter in the long run? No, it did not matter at all. And the final point here is, you know, if you're going to do a U-turn, do it Theresa May way. She is so decisive when she does a U-turn. And then the final point, the final sort of paradox, is that we've had record high turnouts in recent referendums, EU referendum, Scottish referendum, independence referendum, but that has left, if anything, people feeling less politically engaged, not more. So obviously we all know the turnout figure in the EU referendum. I know it particularly well because I got it right in the office sweepstake, and that really matters when you work in my business. 72%. And we saw 1.5 million voters come out of the blue who had been disengaged and not voting for decades, coming out and voting Leave, and they were typically in those left-behind locations in the north of England. But that, you know, the EU referendum was such a different issue. It, you know, brought to the surface how people felt about lots of fundamental values. It felt like a binary issue. It felt like something would change as a result of voting Remain or Leave, and that is not how people feel about politics. The main thing that people are telling us about this election is that they are extremely bored of it. And I think, actually, probably quite a lot of people, and we're talking as a panel, you know, if we're a bit bored of it, oh my goodness, can you imagine how bored normal people are? But there is a key point about disengagement in that voters do not like being taken for granted. This election is being positioned as a foregone conclusion, and the data does support that. But, you know, from a voting perspective, you know, many people just cannot see the point. It all feels very boring. All feels like too much. So Kevin from Birmingham Erdington last week summed this up for us. I've had to vote so much in the past few years, I feel like a ferry going back and forth to the polling station. Enough. Please make it stop. So, you know, I think he speaks for a lot of people there.
Maybe Edmonton Man will become the character of this election. Clearly, before I pass on to Miranda, just one quick question. There is clearly a two-party crunch that's going on, which obviously has impacted UKIP, Lib Dems, and possibly Greens as well. Do you think Labour's recovery is almost because of the Conservative Party's strength, that people are looking for whatever the alternative is, knowing full well that it may not come to pass that you'll have a Jeremy Corbyn-led government, so it kind of gives them licence to go for Labour just to provide a stonewall of opposition?
I think that's a little bit sophisticated, if I'm honest. I think it's that Labour have been saying some quite interesting things, and that's got a little bit of traction, and they're not hearing very much from the Lib Dems and the Greens in comparison. Just because they say in a poll that they will vote Labour, it does not mean that they will necessarily vote Labour. And I think that's a really, really key thing to think about. Are these people actually going to vote Labour on the day? I think the kind of, when you actually speak to people and dig down the surface and look at in the whites of their eyes, there's a lot to suggest that they won't.
Good. Very useful. We might come back to that point. Miranda, over to you.
Thanks very much, and thank you all for coming. Just to pick up on Cordelia's point about people being sick of elections, I agree with that very much. And there was a wonderful joke which I'd just like to share with you, which is that sometimes polling stations are used as primary schools. I think it feels quite weird this time because there seems to be so much at stake and actually really dramatic movements going on in politics. And yet the actual outcome of the June the 8th poll seems, A, entirely predictable, and B, not necessarily to be able to change the course of these extraordinarily dramatic events that we're living through. Since the Conservative Party has decided not to actually explain, even in their very detailed manifesto on other issues, what they mean by Brexit means Brexit, even the mandate that Theresa May says she is seeking to go through with Brexit, we're not any clearer on that, so it doesn't feel as if the election actually affects that in any real sense. And then, of course, what's happened to the opposition parties means that it's become a kind of strange carnival of disaster on the left. So you've got this kind of monolithic Tory campaign where we might almost be accidentally about as a country to give them a mandate to do all sorts of dramatic things but without any detail about how it would work. And then a sort of, you know, bizarre events elsewhere. So I just wanted to deal a bit with what I think has happened to the opposition parties, if that's okay. So to deal with the SNP quickly, because clearly Scottish politics operates under different under different rules, and the, you know, the extraordinary rise of the SNP in the last few years means it operates differently there. But the SNP, for example, even has problems when faced with Theresa May's Conservative Party, partly because of Ruth Davidson is such a good leader of the Scottish Conservatives, but also because in this atmosphere of voter fatigue and all the rest of it, deciding to focus early on promising a second independence referendum turned out to be an appalling tactical error. So we can expect a Tory revival in Scotland, something we all probably thought would never happen in our lifetime. So that's an extraordinary thing in and of itself. Then, you know, what's happened to the Labour Party in recent years is the sort of terrible coming to pass of that statement by, I think it was Neil Kinnock, when Ed Miliband was elect leader of the Labour Party, who said, "We've got our party back." Well, boy, has the left got their party back, you know, and with disastrous results. And I think, although it's very true that the Labour manifesto had some interesting things in it, and the leaking, however it happened, gave them this strange boost of having their ideas discussed for a longer period than you would have expected, given the rest of the election campaign. As Cordelia was rightly saying, that isn't necessarily going to affect anybody's vote. So, again, it seems like a kind of strange sideshow of an election campaign we could be having, but we're not. You know, we could be having an election campaign where we actually talked about some ideas and policies, but we're not having that, you know. So that's slightly odd. And I think also this issue that you raised about people feeling they can express some support for Labour ideas and even maybe for the kind of weird idealism of the left, safe in the knowledge they're not going to get it in number 10, is a quite interesting phenomenon as well. And somebody tweeted back at me the other day what I thought was a wonderful phrase, which I intend to use as soon as I can think of a piece to put it into, which was, you know, these people are recreational radicals, which is wonderful, I think, because it sort of it absolves you of responsibility of actually having to, you know, do any of it, but you can parade your idealism. And certainly, you know, my colleagues who are out and about say there's a huge doorstep problem with Corbyn himself, and it isn't necessarily this manifesto stuff about whether it adds up. It is a lot of it this issue to do with Corbyn and security, which I think in the current context is going to make a big difference, even in very traditional Labour heartlands, unfortunately. And if you look, the FT has got Matt Singh doing election analysis this time, and he's not a pollster, but he crawls over the polls. And he published something on Monday, which I would really recommend, which is how well the Conservative Party is doing in traditional manufacturing areas. So, you know, this is a massive territorial land grab by the Conservative Party that's going on, somewhat under the radar, and part of the question is whether you can rewind from that position. Can the Labour Party rewind from that once it's happened? You know, it's a kind of short circuiting of Trump populism by getting into that kind of British Rust Belt with some sort of message that resonates. So I think that's really interesting to watch. And I think then there's the kind of disaster that is the Lib Dems, who, obviously, in a binary election, get squeezed, and that seems to be happening in spades this time without the usual kind of bounce that they get at the beginning and the middle of the campaign. You usually get a squeeze on the Lib Dems in the last few days, but, I mean, there's just a kind of permanent squeeze down into single figures. And I think they've made quite a lot of tactical errors. You know, this thing about being the Remainiac party, you know, that theory was actually tested to destruction already in the 2014 European elections, where we found it was about 7 or 8%, and hey, wow, it does turn out to be a 7 or 8%. So that's been a disaster, though. Of course, they weren't expecting a snap election. They were expecting by 2020 that the Brexit negotiations would maybe be in the weeds and the message would be much more detailed and more popular for that reason. I think it's important to remember that. But and then they've also got this sort of problem that they're also faced with of Theresa May's new big tent. You know, in the 1990s and the 2000s, the Labour Party were the geniuses of creating a big tent. Now the Tory party is determined to do that again. And one of the things that clearly happened in 2015 was that a lot of people moved across from being Lib Dem supporters through the coalition, which sort of detoxified the Tory party. And they're now Tory voters, you know. And there was a very cruel phrase used by a Tory strategist, which was that the coalition made voting Lib Dem a gateway drug to becoming a Conservative. So I think there's quite a lot of that going on. But one thing that I do think is fascinating and which was worth thinking about is that, you know, For a number of years now, all of us who kind of obsess about these things have been watching this long, slow decline of party membership and of support for the two main parties. You know, I think the election that's always quoted on this, Cordelia will probably correct me if I've got it wrong, I think it's 1951, where the combined party vote for Conservative and Labour was in the mid to high 90s. You know, that's extraordinary. And then we've had a lot of years where that's fallen away, and it seemed as if we were living in a more pluralistic age. And then here we are in an election where it looks as if the combined vote share of the two main parties could be up to kind of what it used to be in the 1970s almost, and all other players squeezed out. So it'd be really interesting to know whether this binary choice thing is the aberration, because it's a Brexit election, or whether the period of kind of nascent pluralism turns out to have been the aberration. So anyway, those are my thoughts about this what really fascinating election that seems very dull day to day.
Great. Thank you very much. Lost it, you on air. Julia, I'm going to hand over to you.
Hi, I'm Julia. I'm the editor of the digital news section of the New Statesman. And one of our main preoccupations is the opposition at the moment, because we're a left-leaning publication. Our readers have traditionally been Labour, but they may be not anymore. They might be supporters of the SNP if they're in Scotland, or supporters of the Scottish Greens or the English Greens, or they might be floating voters. So one of the big questions for us is what happens after the election, what kind of opposition are we left with, and can they actually produce something that is going to provide scrutiny of a government that looks likely to have a larger Tory majority than before, and also is, as people have already said on the panel, embarking on this huge Brexit project, which one thing we haven't talked about is, for example, the use of Henry VIII clauses in the legislation, which means that some of the changes, because we're taking EU legislation and embedding it straight away into UK law, part of that in the small print is that then the government can tinker with what this means. And as it stands, that's not going to be up for scrutiny in the way we might expect it to. So we have a very powerful government coming in June or July, who is going to be the one looking over the small print and raising the awkward questions. So I just thought I'd mention, back in autumn when everyone was talking about an early election, before Theresa May had dampened everyone's hopes so much that we really were surprised when she announced it, Peter Mandelson, that architect of New Labour, said, "I pray every day for an early election to put Labour out of its misery." Well, now it's coming. And there is a debate in the left that has been going on for pretty much since 2015 and when Jeremy Corbyn was elected, about what a successful Labour Party looks like. And I think there is a group within Labour that in some ways are willing this election on because they feel it will prove their point to the rest of the party. Look, we've been talking the truth. Voters do not love Jeremy Corbyn, and there are still people who do believe that voters love Jeremy Corbyn. And now can we please get on with the New Labour project again? I think those voices are smaller than they were before, because Brexit has also been a huge shock, again, to people like Peter Mandelson, who was also an incredibly pro-European politician. And so there will be a day of reckoning, but there will also be a struggle to find a leadership that can actually embody Labour as it stands today, which is not necessarily Jeremy Corbyn's Labour, but it's also not necessarily New Labour. And another thing that has changed, and Miranda's already talked about it, is the idea of plural politics. And without wanting to disregard the vote share, the fact remains, under first past the post, the largest party coming out of Scotland is likely to be the SNP. I think most estimates for Tory seats in Scotland are around 5 or 6. I've heard 12, but that seems a bit excessive. So because of the way that votes are delivered under first past the post, the SNP will still be a sizeable presence at Westminster. So one of the questions for Labour, which is likely to be diminished, is who do we work with? Can we work with the SNP, for example? Can we work with the Liberal Democrats? Where do the one or two Greens fit into this? And can we do anything more successful than we've managed up till now? And there is a big debate going on about the idea of a progressive alliance. Scottish Labour absolutely hate the idea because they say the SNP are not progressive and they're not our allies. But some people do think that's the only way the Labour Party will be an effective force going forward. I think we will see a lot more cooperation between opposition parties on certain issues, especially around Brexit. That brings me to the second point, which is Labour's view on Brexit, which has been a painful argument over the year. And they have just about found a place that they can agree on in what has been articulated by Keir Starmer, who's the shadow Brexit secretary, which is basically, we accept Brexit, but we don't accept the willingness to turn our backs on the single market, and we want rights for EU citizens. I think if rights for EU citizens aren't immediately granted by the new Tory government, I think that will be an area that the opposition can rally around. Almost everyone's in agreement with that, including many people who voted Leave. I think the single market is a more difficult one for the left because some people are actually quite excited about the idea that we're free now of all the EU constraints on nationalisation. So I suspect it will be a dry debate, but it's one that will continue. Then there's also the idea of leadership. I've suggested already I don't think that Jeremy Corbyn will be able to hang on if they lose. I think he may continue for a few months, but I think ultimately most people would recognise that you resign after you lose an election. I think also Corbynistas may feel they have achieved quite a lot already, because if you think about it, at the last election, Labour still was vaguely in favour of austerity. Now there's no doubt that it's against austerity in those particular cuts. So I guess the question will be, who can lead, who wants to lead the Labour Party just now? And there's a couple of, there's a couple of different corners. There's people like Chuka Amuna, who are very much pro-European, very comfortable in a pro-business environment, quite associated with London and the old Ed Miliband government as well. Then you have people like Lisa Nandy, who's not so well known outside Labour, but is from Wigan and has quite a nuanced view on Brexit and talks a lot about solidarity. She's from the soft left and talks a lot about workers' rights and securities. And then you have actually Lisa Nandy and also Clive Lewis, who was a Corbynista's rising star, but then fell out of favour a little bit recently. They talk about a progressive alliance. So again, that's a very different idea of a Labour Party. And then you have many other names bandied around, perhaps someone from the more Brexity side of the party. And you might be surprised how many Labour MPs secretly say things that are really quite hard to distinguish from UKIP, for example, on controlling immigration. But they're the kind of MPs you don't see much of because they're very much in their constituencies. So I think for the left, the interesting story is going to start on 8th of June.
Great, interesting. Thank you. Julia, I imagine the Amunas, Nandys, Lewises of this world will be watching what Kinnock did in 1983. Where he pretty much launched his campaign, leadership campaign, as soon as the polls closed. And I think there might be a very early mover if things pan out as we're expecting.
I forgot to mention someone as well, Keir Starmer, who has remained... I think what Keir's done is very interesting because he's one of the few people who resigned in June last year who went back into the shadow cabinet. And as such, he's positioned in a way that he is both seen as relatively loyal to Corbyn for that section of the membership, but he's also seen as a fairly centrist Labour politician.
Yeah.
And he's not necessarily said anything, but I think the fact that he's there giving speeches about Brexit puts him in an obvious leadership position.
Great, thank you very much. Okay, over to you, Katie.
I'm going to try and not say too much that everyone else has already said, but it might not work. So, we've heard a few times already just on this panel, how boring this election is. Everyone seems quite tired of it before they've even got to the polls. I think this is because it seems quite obvious that Theresa May will win. I think the fact that on Sunday, we all got very excited that a poll in the Sunday Times had shown that the Tory lead was now at single figures at 9 points, which is still quite a decent lead. shows, like, you know, how assured they are. And you can see that in the Conservative campaign, we have this no-frills manifesto. Well, they didn't really seem to be trying to woo any voters, particularly give you a reason. They said, we might raise taxes, we might stop some of the perks you thought you'd have for 5 years. And also in the fact that Theresa May doesn't feel like she needs to do the debates. Again, she seems very assured in her position. Again, also on the constituency visits, Jeremy Corbyn seems to quite partial to visiting safe spaces, so places where he has a majority of over 10,000, whereas Theresa May is obviously pitching to Labour voters by not really going to that many safe constituencies. Instead, she's going to ones with quite decent Labour majorities she would have to shift. I mean, all elections, in a way, are historic. I think this one, although it seems dull, could end up being very, you know, it has a big bearing on, you know, the future of Britain. A landmark victory for May would mean a lot of things to, for different reasons. I mean, one which I think has been covered less is what it would mean for conservatism. For many conservatives, Theresa May is quite left. She, at The Spectator, we did a cover recently, which was Theresa May digging up the Miliband's, you know, the Edstone. And this is because, I mean, for example, I don't even remember, in 2015, we heard about the energy price cap policy that Ed Miliband came up with, and David Cameron told us that it was proof that Ed was living in a Marxist fantasy land. A near replica is now in the 2017 Tory manifesto. And that does worry some Conservative MPs. So if Conservative does turn a little bit more shade red, that would help Theresa May obviously pledge to the centre ground. And she's talked about having it being a mainstream party, and it's a mainstream manifesto. I think there are a few hurdles before we get there, before we talk about how big this majority could be. I mean, some people say it's going to be like near 200. MPs have been told not to speculate, partly because they don't look complacent, and also I think so they don't end up with egg on their face. I think anything under 50 would be seen as a big disappointment, but some don't think, you know, necessarily be more than 100. The problem that the Tories have is that some voters are very tribal, and if you look at the lead so far, the reason the Tories are so high up is largely down to the collapse of the UKIP vote. So UKIP voters have gone to the Conservative Party, and that's why UKIP, I think some polls only have them on like 3%. And that means that Labour voters, for all the talk of how the Tories are going to win Labour voters, it hasn't happened yet. You might be getting some, but as well they'll go for that. And some issues, like I think Theresa May may have made a mistake when she spoke about fox hunting, because canvassers say that that is something that's come up repeatedly. If you are a Labour voter who's thinking of voting Conservative and you like some of her policies, you know, in terms of making society fairer, cracking down on corporations, and then you also hear about someone wanting to, you know, go fox hunting, or not her personally, I think that seems like the old nasty party maybe that you would never have voted for. But that is why Theresa May has tried to kind of almost ignore the Conservative brand in this election. At the Tory manifesto launch, we saw, you know, Theresa May, and then very small print at the bottom of the banners, it had, you know, Conservative Party. Mm-hmm. And also at other launches, we've heard about Theresa May's team. Again, no mention of the Tories. And lots of candidates are saying that, not that they're the, you know, the Tory candidate, they're Theresa May's local candidate. This seems to be having some cut through, partly this whole, you know, the grammar schools. In a way, is one Conservative, part joking, said to me, they wonder if the reason that Theresa May had made such a big issue of grammar schools is so that everyone in the country now knows she went to a grammar school. It means that people kind of reconcile with her. They're like, she isn't an old Etonian, you can relate to her more, and that's really cut through. But I think there are still problems there. I have a friend who works for the BBC who was vox-popping in a Labour heartland. And one voter, they asked him how he was going to vote, and he was like, well, I'm not going to vote for Jeremy Corbyn because he's just a bit weird. Don't like him on the television. I said, I'm not going to vote for the Tories because they're Tories, so why would I vote for them? So it's got to be Theresa May. The problem the Tories have in terms of how big the majority will be is what happens when voters like this voter get into the polling booth and they don't see Theresa May, they see Conservative. And I think that's the big challenge in terms of how landmark victory this will be.
Great, thank you very much.
OK, I'd like to start on this question of leadership, because clearly it's so core, and I think you've all touched on that theme quite strongly in your opening remarks. And I think the disappointing thing about this election campaign so far is I don't get a sense that Theresa May has really been tested. And that was starting to happen, obviously, on Sunday, Monday. She had a very difficult interview with Andrew Neil. And the fear has to be is because she hasn't been tested, how much do we truly know about her leadership capacity as we go into the hard grind and hard politics of Brexit negotiations and all of that will encompass? Is that a fear that the panel has as well?
Well, I mean, one thing that we've noticed, particularly my colleagues who were at the New Statesman for the 2015 election, I was at the Mirror at the time, is that the policies that were condemned widely when Ed Miliband had them are now being praised to the skies by the Daily Mail. So I suppose you could say that the traditional right-wing scepticism of anything that seems at all left-wing is missing this time round.
And the Daily Mail seems to support a sort of random inheritance tax as well, quite bizarrely. Cordelia, what do you think?
I think a lot of voters wouldn't necessarily agree that she hasn't been tested. And I think one of the key things about leadership is your ability to lead and keep together a party. And a lot of people who are interested in thinking about voting Labour and voted Labour in 2015... The thing they actually worry about Jeremy Corbyn is his ability to keep the party together, and their overwhelming view of the Labour brand is that it's kind of disunity, and they know it's very fractured and it doesn't feel like one coherent unit. And they think that Theresa May, in contrast, has seemed to have done a very good job of bringing together a party that they know has historically sometimes been quite hard to reconcile. So I'm not sure voters would necessarily agree that she hasn't been tested hard, but you know, totally agree from kind of a Westminster perspective that she's had an incredibly easy ride. What voters do care about is that there seems to be absolutely no opposition, no credible opposition. That is what voters care about, and that is leaving people very, very let down.
Randa. I think she is going to be tested.
She is.
That's the point. So I think we're right to be a bit concerned about it. Clearly, this line about you have to vote for me to give me a strong hand in the negotiations in Brussels is a load of old nonsense, but it would potentially give her a stronger hand with her own backbenchers, and I think that's the thing we don't know. We don't know the exact makeup of the Conservative Party post June the 9th and how strong this feeling that she's delivered a famous victory for them will feel to people who are quite hardline Brexiters, because it seems to me that... So, I mean, one of the things about this election is a constant search for chinks of light, if you're not a Conservative. OK, so one of the chinks of light is the fact that by holding the snap election now, she doesn't have to face the voters in 2020, which could be a really bad moment for Brexit. And that could mean, because she can wait till 2020... to have another general election, that she's building in room for compromise on Brexit. And these compromises really will be necessary. I mean, I cannot feel it to be true that the Conservative Party, for all of this kind of mood music about moving to the left, about hearing the messages of Brexit, about, you know, absorbing all these UKIP voters, I cannot believe that the Conservative Party would deliberately wreck the economy. I just can't see it. Do you know what I mean? And there's got to be some compromises, perhaps some of them even on the hot button topic of immigration. So this idea of her leadership being tested, it really is going to be. And within her own party and within this new coalition of voters that she's putting together post the Brexit referendum, because there will be cries of betrayal. And how will she handle that?
Yeah, and what's interesting as a corollary to what Cordelia was describing is, you know, the two-thirds of the electorate and I sort of Brexit get on with it. Well, in Europe, there's an attitude that's hardened around Brexit, get on with it. And by the way, it's going to be on our terms. Mm. So it'll be interesting to see how that plays out. Katie, Theresa May and... has she been tested enough?
I think for someone who likes to tell us they're strong and stable about 6-7 times a day, she's had a surprising number of U-turns. but the thing is, she's compared to... it's who you're compared with, isn't it? So yes. I think it probably is still quite fair to say she's the most strong and stable of the people you get to choose from on June the 8th. But that's not
slogan as
catchy. They can try that. I mean, I think it's going to get harder for her. She's obviously going to disappoint some people. And also, I think in a way, even in her own party, be being quite willing to give her a slight benefit of the doubt when she's U-turned on things like national insurance in the budget and on whether you're going to have an early election, because they involved factors that were a little bit out of her control. It's hard to remember now, but she was a Remainer, and therefore Brexit was a situation she didn't really create that now she's dealing with. And secondly, she didn't write the 2015 manifesto, which said you couldn't raise tax for 5 years. I think now that she has written this manifesto and she is fully in charge, any mistakes she makes, she's going to be judged on a lot harder and have a less forgiving party, which is why, again, she'll hope that she has such a big majority, it's fine to annoy more people.
Okay, interesting. Now, the other sort of theme in this is sort of policy versus leadership in the minds of the electorate. And there are certainly elements of the Labour Party who say, look, you know, the electorate support these left-wing policies. It's all going to be fine. And it's kind of interesting because the contention of New Labour was always you had to get the policy at a point of exactness on the centre ground, as well as having the leadership of a figure like Tony Blair to pull it off. And obviously, Labour election victories, by the way, are really rare. I was born in 1975. Only one Labour leader has won a majority in my lifetime. I'm not that young, right? So this is tough for Labour. But it'd be interesting to get the perspective of the panel. Was that contention of New Labour right, that you needed the policy and the leader? Or is there some credibility in the argument that maybe the electorate are more relaxed about the policy agenda as long as the leader is right? Let's go for Cordelia.
Yeah, there's a really interesting Comrades poll out last week, I think, where they tested each of Labour's key policy announcements, and at least half of the public thought that they were all really good, some of them really high, 70, 80%. Then they were asked at the end of the survey, and they were told these were Labour policies, and then they were asked at the end of the survey, who has a better plan for Britain, Labour or the Conservatives? And, you know, overwhelmingly the Conservatives were picked over Labour. And so I think that really speaks to something there, that individual policies are important to people who are really engaged in politics. For people who have better things to do, for normal people, they are looking at... normal people. They are looking at, you know, leadership as a proxy for all sorts of policy issues and values. And actually, they don't have time to engage with the detail. They don't want to engage with the detail. The detail feels too complex and abstract. And they want to vote on something that feels clear to them. And leadership feels much clearer. And I think, you know, this is the key challenge for Labour. Lots of those policies are really popular, but people don't believe that Labour has the credibility to deliver them. They don't believe that the sums add up. So actually, that doesn't matter at all.
So, Miranda, do you think there's a wider range of parameters around possible policy platforms? Or do you think it's as narrow as New Labour would have contended?
I think it might be getting wider, because I think we don't live in the 1990s anymore. You know, and the 1990s were relatively predictable. They were economically predictable and safer. You know, we live in very, very turbulent times, you know, not least in terms of what's happened with foreign policy and terrorism and security as well. But unfortunately, I do think that even though things might be shifting and people might be open to, you know, slightly broader range of tools to be used by a leader from either side of the political spectrum, I think there are some kind of fundamental laws of politics that still apply. And one of those is what Cordelia's alluding to, this idea that it matters more who's saying it than what you're saying. So, you know, the trick that Theresa May is trying to pull off, and I mean, Katie, you're quite right to kind of caution us that we don't actually have proof that it's going to work yet, that this trick she's trying to pull off of kind of stealing other people's clothes and sort of shape-shifting, that was a great Blair talent as well. And you need to be able to surprise people, and if they trust you, then you can challenge them on quite fundamental things. I mean, the social care policy on which Theresa May's had to U-turn is a really interesting example, yeah. Because inserted at the last minute into the Conservative manifesto, it would effectively strip families of their inheritance built up through property over the last decades of extraordinary house price growth. I mean, it is incredibly radical policy. And I mean, it's a class war policy, actually, which is clearly why it couldn't stay in the Tory party manifesto. But some version of that policy might emerge at the end of the long-term discussion about this and might have to be sold to the electorate. So I think we are living through times where it's become a bit more flexible what you can try to sell. but the person selling the policy's got to be the right person, fundamentally.
So, Katie, I mean, it seems that Theresa May has extraordinary room for manoeuvre, which she is using, not least on social care, but on the Brexit policy as well, a whole series of sort of consumer interventions and tax policy also.
Yeah, I think she's testing out almost the opposite of your premise. So is the policy enough? Maybe not. Is the leader with very little policies that you want enough? That seems to be what she's doing. But it's partly because she wants to be realistic about this. In 2015, I think there were 625 pledges in that manifesto. And they're all, you know, amazing news. Like, you're not going to have your national insurance raised and all these things. But the problem was the Tories were so confident they weren't going to get a majority that they thought they could promise the world and then negotiate away the harder bits in the coalition discussions that would follow. I mean, May realises that realistically, she's not going to have that. So she has to be a bit more less sweet shop in what she offers. But I think part of the reason Labour have less a bit of a credibility issue, yes, you like all their policies, they sound very nice, but they're going to scrap all tuition fees and they're also going to keep the pensions triple lock. So they're helping pensioners and they're helping young people. And you kind of think, if this was so easy to do, would have had it before. So I think a lot of people are just slightly mistrusting of the idea you can actually have all those nice things and how you would actually achieve them, which means there's no point having a good policy if you don't believe someone can deliver it.
Yeah, there seems to be a compounding effect in the case of Labour, doesn't there? Where you keep on stacking them to the point where actually the stack falls over, potentially. Julia, this really matters for as you contend, Jeremy Corbyn steps down. It really matters for who could follow him, because if there is a wider range of acceptable policy agendas, then it widens the range of potential leaders, doesn't it?
Yeah, and one thing we haven't really talked about is the impact of the financial crash, which I think still is shaping politics today. Yeah. And, for example, some of the questions that have been thrown up, not just in the UK but in France, are things around job security. What do you do as more and more people are self-employed? And how do you come up with a labour policy that makes sense? And I think that's one of the big issues for any left-wing leader. In terms of the trust in the leader versus their policies, we had an article looking at the Labour manifesto, which compared it was a Labour historian. He thought it was most like the 1997 manifesto, but again, people didn't believe that Jeremy Corbyn actually adhered to any of it. I think the next Labour leader, if they're going to be successful, and as you say, it is rare, and actually there are a lot of things stacked against them, starting with the number of right-wing newspapers, is that you have to be an exceptional media performer, and you have to be exceptionally good at making people trust you. So unfortunately, I'm struggling to find an individual that's that charismatic on the tip of my tongue.
Answers on the postcard. Right.
Would I just be able to intervene momentarily to defend Tony Blair?
Yes.
Because I think that we might be forgetting how radical the Blair government was. I mean, it's true that they were really good at selling it to Middle England, but, you know, if you think that some of the first things they did when they came in were, you know, the national minimum wage, which a whole bunch of economists from both sides of the political spectrum had told them would be a disaster and turned out not to be a disaster at all. It was actually a really good idea. And, you know, the windfall tax on the utilities, a retrospective tax on privatised industry. I mean, can you imagine if Jeremy Corbyn actually proposed that, you know, and they went ahead and they did it, you know, and used the money for welfare. Yeah. So actually, it's not true that you can't do anything.
You gotta go. Well, that's an important corrective. And on that note, I'm going to open it out to the audience. I'm going to take Rima, then I'm going to take the gentleman at the back there, and then I'm going to take the gentleman in the middle there.
Declaration of interest. I am a member of staff at the RSA in the economy team. I have a question picking up on this point about the 1.5 million voters who came out to vote in the EU referendum. And just wanted to contrast that with the low turnout expected in this general election. My question is simply that it looks as if there's going to be quite a stark contrast in levels of turnout. Does that demonstrate some failures in the way that general elections are undertaken, the quality of our democracy, and failures in the way in which representative democracy currently works?
Thank you. I'd like to come back to an earlier theme. The political class and the Today programme love going over a manifesto and interrogating people about it and things like this. But they're actually heeded by a very small percentage of the electorate. With the rise of populism and Trumpism, which means increasingly the politically naive and the politically ignorant are the ones who are actually going to determine what sort of government we get by the way they vote, have we moved into a post-manifesto politics in this country where what you really need is a slogan, preferably in 140 characters and no more, which you can put about? And really, it's just trust me because I'm a trustworthy sort of person. Because I've listened to some of the Vox Pop, and people are openly attributing policies which are clearly set out in party manifestos to the wrong party.
Okay.
I mean, the political ignorance is massive. I should explain I'm a former MP.
Oh, I'm good. Thank you very much. And then this gentleman in the middle.
Do you think younger voters have actually going to have their voice? Because you've seen probably, I think, about 2 million or so registering to vote, and a lot of those are younger voters. So are we going to see quite a big seismic shift of actually younger voters actually going out there and voting?
Okay, so we've got the quality of our democracy, and I should say we are running a citizen economic council, which is experimenting with deliberative engagement, so we just need to be transparent about that. Are we in a post-manifesto age, and does this surge in youth electoral registration portend something in a couple of weeks' time? Let's start off with Katie.
I think on manifestos, I don't think that many people paid too much attention to them. There was an experiment they did on the Daily Politics last week when they were in Newcastle, and they had, not that scientific, they had a tank of balls, and you put a ball in if if a manifesto would affect the way you voted. The Noes had it, and it was a six-year-old girl who had to explain why manifestos were good. She said that, if you don't read the manifesto, you don't know what's going to happen to your country, and it's quite important to know what's going to happen to your country. Unfortunately, she can't vote. but I think it's partly just because there's lots of policies, especially, I mean, I know I was at university when the Lib Dems were doing their first with Nick Clegg, and they told us they were going to scrap tuition fees. Lots of my friends voted for the Lib Dems. And then, obviously, it's because of coalition, but lots of people don't bother with the complexities of why that policy went. All they know is they voted for someone, they did appear in government in some format, and that policy didn't happen. So why would you pay too much attention to a policy? As for the Today programme, I mean, the Linton Crosby test, and he is the man who's in charge of the Conservative campaign and also was in 2015, is Magic FM. So it doesn't matter what's on the Today programme. All that matters is what's on the Magic FM news bulletin. And that is if you know if your message is getting ahead. So I think if you want to know how the campaigns are really doing, that's where you should be turning your attention.
Great. Thank you, Katie. Julia.
Yeah, on that manifesto question, I just want to talk a bit about the use of social media in this election. There's been some interesting articles looking at how parties are targeting their messaging at very specific social spheres. And on the one hand, this could be a good thing because you could potentially get a manifesto pledge to many more people who are interested in it. The downside is we don't actually really know what other people are hearing about the election. And I think we saw this with Brexit as well. For example, a very widely watched film was Brexit the movie, but I'm pretty sure all of my friends who voted Remain had never even heard of this.
Yeah.
In terms of young people registering to vote, I don't know the figures. I would suspect that some of them are people who are re-registering, because one of the issues with young people is that because they're more likely to rent and move around, they drop off the electoral register. And I actually feel quite passionately this is something the government or, our electoral societies need to address.
Cordelia.
I think the first question about sort of turnout and does this demonstrate democratic failure was kind of answered by the third question about younger people. I think what it does speak to a failure on is kind of letting political agendas be so dominated by older voters. You know, there is such an overwhelming difference between older people and younger people in how likely they are to vote, and parties have ruthlessly pursued, particularly the Conservative Party, have ruthlessly pursued the older vote and been able to sort of completely ignore younger voters because they're just not turning out and voting. I think that's the particular failure there, which is why, in a way, Theresa May's first social care policy was you know, obviously some people would call it stupid, but in some ways it was really brave because it was hitting the people that are most likely to vote Conservative and most likely to turn out and vote the hardest. But I think the key is around younger voters and the fact that younger people feel that they have no voice in politics, and there's this kind of awful, perpetual, vicious cycle where they're not voting, so politicians don't talk to them, don't talk about anything that they care about, and that is just continuing. I would really agree with you that I'm not sure we are going to see a massive surge in younger voters, and I think politicians are really, really bad at talking to younger voters. I don't think, you know, Jeremy Corbyn's grime scene thing is gonna see a huge surge in younger votes.
Who knows? I have to say, I've always argued very strongly that it was alienation rather than apathy that was keeping youth engagement down, or at least youth voting down. I've started to doubt that somewhat. And the reason is, going back to the social media point, I wonder whether there are lots of other bubbles that people are contained within, and actually they don't even touch the politics bubble. They touch the lifestyle style bubbles in different ways. And so my fear is actually now it's more of a blend of apathy and alienation, with leaning towards apathy in a way that maybe it wasn't 15, 20 years ago. I don't know. That's just a hypothesis. Randa.
So on turnout, I mean, the Brexit referendum turnout was obviously very, very, very high, and unexpectedly high. But, you know, so both of the parties who are promising another referendum, the SNP and the Lib Dems, are finding that that's not popular. So I think this idea of actually voter fatigue rather than apathy is something you kind of have to take seriously. And I think it's got a deeper point behind it. And, you know, I think it's slightly lame just saying people can't be bothered. I'm not accusing you of that, of course, but, you know, there are those who say if you don't turn up, you can't complain afterwards, as it were. Because I think there is actually something fundamental about voting in a government and then wanting them to get on with it. I mean, you know, you're kind of delegating responsibility, and I think that's kind of fine, actually. Yeah. And also, whether people are sort of angry enough to vote, as they did in the Brexit referendum, isn't actually possibly that healthy. You know, you could see relatively slowly declining turnouts, because it's not exactly a crisis in turnout in this country, as actually people being relatively okay. I mean, it's also a function of whether things have foregone conclusion. I mean, 2001, for example, was very, very low turnout because everyone knew that Blair was going to win, so it wasn't really an issue. So I'm not sure that I think it's a total crisis in terms of turnout. You can't, in the same way, you could sort of slightly, I'm a bit uncomfortable at complaining about populism and complaining about low turnout, because maybe people are sort of okay.
I have to say, one thing about a national referendum is your vote does count, and it can make a difference,
yes,
particularly
true.
In a close one. And, you know, I think that message did kind of get through towards the closing part of the referendum campaigns. Let's take a quick fire round.
Do the panel think that political betting will more accurately predict the outcome than traditional polling?
Cordelia, one for you.
I think that there is something in sort of what people think is going to happen, and just asking people a really straight question of who they think is going to win, and that was actually a great predictor in the 2015 election, and that tends to be a lot more aligned with political betting. I think the key thing to note is the way that the polls have been used historically has been based on a really simplistic understanding of how that works, and actually there's so much more to it. But polling is not a perfect science, and if the polls are wrong again this time, which they may well be, I don't think there's anything to suggest that they won't be wrong again, what they tend to do when they are wrong is they tend to overstate the Labour vote share and understate the Conservative vote share, particularly when you're looking at online methodologies. And none of the pollsters, apart from Ipsos Mori, are doing any phone surveys. So I think if the polls are wrong again, which they may well be, it will play in the Conservatives' favour.
Does anyone have any strong views on this one before we get into the final question?
I would say that we tend to look at the polls rather than political betting, because we consider political betting to generally get their information from the polls. In terms of the polling samples, I had an interesting discussion recently with YouGov about the changes they've made over the last year. I think one thing that came up in this discussion is a pollster can get it wrong by quite a large margin, but because they're on the right side of the ultimate result, no one notices, whereas they actually might be within a small margin of error, but because it's on the wrong side, it's seen as terrible. So there may be some huge margins of error this time in June, but no one notices because they predicted conservatives.
I would just add to that because we've had very recent local elections, they may be a much better guide, and the Conservatives did very well and the other parties did poorly. And also the leadership ratings on leadership and ratings on stewardship of the economy are always much, much better predictors of who's going to win than the opinion polls or the markets or the betting markets. So don't look at Sterling, because Sterling's got it wrong every time for the last couple of years.
Okay, I'm going to, if okay with you, Katie, I'm going to pitch in with a final question. And the question is this. Thinking forward to 2020, who is going to be leader of the Conservative Party? Who is going to be leader of the Labour Party? And who is going to be leader of the Liberal Democrats? I'm going to ask Katie first.
I think Labour, can I hedge between two?
You can.
Okay, I'll cheat. I think it'll be either be Yvette Cooper or John McDonnell, depending on who wins the fight for Labour. And then I think it would probably still be Theresa May. If for some reason not, then I think the two to look to are probably David Davis, who actually very good bets on him at the moment, very good odds. And also, I mean, Boris Johnson is much talked about, but we'll see if he survives a reshuffle. And then with the Lib Dems, I don't know. I mean, I saw some odds recently that Tim Farron, I mean, he will probably keep his seat, but it's not a complete given that he'll even keep his seat in this election. But so I wouldn't know yet with the Lib Dems, because we'll have to see who's left.
Randa.
Oh, dear, oh, dear. OK. So I'm going to say that Lisa Nandy's going to be leader of the Labour Party, because I really like her. I think she's a good egg. So I'm hoping to sort of, you know, start a bit of a bandwagon for Nandy. But I think she'll be in charge of a kind of really unhappy ship of trying to keep everybody together under a sort of soft left banner. I have no idea whether Theresa May will still be there, but I mean, I think she will, unless there's some huge accident that befalls her politically. I think that, well, again, in the spirit of predicting Lisa Nandy, I'm going to hope that the Lib Dems and about 50 or 60 of the most moderate, reasonable Labour MPs are finding a way to live together by that time. And who knows who the leader of that might be? I mean, it might be Nick Clegg, I don't know.
Interesting. I wouldn't bet on that particular leader, but Cordelia.
So my boss, Deborah, tells me before I do these things, never be pinned down to predicting anything, so you'll regress it. So I'm a bit in horror, and this is from a personal perspective. I think your point about Keir Starmer for Labour, I think, is a really, really interesting point. I think Clive Lewis might have been interesting too, but I don't think it's a guarantee he'll keep his seat, so that rather changes that one. I would imagine Theresa May still Prime Minister, or, gosh, yes, still leader of the Conservatives. Lib Dems, will there be any left? So,
well, I think if Theresa May has one thing, it's staying power. So I'll guess Theresa May for Conservatives. I don't want to choose between Lisa Nandy and Keir Starmer, so I'm going to guess that there's some kind of other leadership battle, but that both of them have that seat at one point. And with the Lib Dems, I genuinely have no idea, but just for the general satisfaction, I think if Julian Huppert reclaimed his seat and then went on to become the leader, he could finally get some revenge on all those people that made fun of him last time.
I always get these things wrong, but I'm going to give it a go. May, Cooper, Cable. There we are. That's my prediction. Okay, thank you very much. An amazing panel, amazing discussion. Thanks to Katie Balls, Miranda Green, Julia Rampen and Cordelia Hay.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, why not download our free app to access video and audio files on the go? Just visit our website, therSA.org, and follow the links to the RSA Vision mobile app.